Hello and welcome to Real Time Strategy, a gaming podcast from PR Pros. I'm Sam Mosier, joined by my co-host Caitlin Redwing. How are you doing this week, Caitlin?
I'm doing well, even though I say that and that feels like a lie because we just were talking about how crazy busy we are with GDC coming up. I think in spite of that, I'm still doing well. I have recovered or I'm pretty recovered. I was befelled by a cold over the weekend, which felt insulting because it was one of my first weekends home where I had no plans for a while and then I spent it sleeping. But anyways, I'm feeling much better now. So all things are looking up.
Yeah, I'm glad you're recovered. Happy to have you back on the show. It was fun doing the show last week with Thibaut talking about Lise Vanga. But I always miss having my co-host next to me. So happy to have you in the chair. And like you said, yeah, GDC is heating up. I'm excited for it. It'll be my first time on the ground at the show, and I'm sure we'll talk about it in a couple weeks. But yeah, it is the talk of all the PR folks, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll have an episode pre-recorded. So we'll still have an episode come out the week of GDC. We won't be recording live while we're there, though I was sort of entertaining the idea, but logistic wise and I know we're going to be so busy. I was like, I just can't do that to us. So maybe next year we'll do like a panel or a live recording and interview someone. But for this year, we'll still have an episode, but our talking about GDC might be the week after or it might be a few episodes out, or we may not even get to it because I know we've got some guests lined up. So TBD on if we'll chat GDC after.
Yeah, no, exactly. So at the very least, you can know that we will not, you won't be missing a week from Real Time Strategy, but you know, expect some guests and us not to give you, if there's any major news breaking from GDC week, we won't be covering it on that episode. That's for sure, because we'll be on the ground. But for this week on Real Time Strategy, we will be discussing major news from last week. And it's unfortunately the farthest we can get from fun news on the show. And that is the massive wave of layoffs running through the games industry at the moment. You know, peeling the curtain back on the show a bit, like, we book guests often weeks to months in advance, and just between everything that we've had programmed for the show, we've never really had an episode dedicated to what has been an ongoing trend since the end of last year. And I think everybody unanimously agreed we hoped we would leave it in 2023, but if anything, it has become even a more defining headline of 2024. We're recording this episode the week following two of the biggest game companies in gaming, joining the layoff wave, and that is Sony or PlayStation and EA. So we thought this week was finally the moment to tackle it, discuss it, and, you know, try to break down what's happening. So, Caitlin, with that preamble, anything to add before I get into the context of what happened last week with PlayStation and EA?
Oh, yeah. It almost felt like we were waiting for the layoffs to end before even being able to like talk about it. But yeah, at this point, we're almost to the second week of March, and like they're not stopping. So we need to talk about it. I'm not say looking forward to talking about it, but like I'm glad we're finally talking about it. But yeah, it is unfortunate the number of layoffs we've had this year. Even in comparison, like we've already surpassed the total of layoffs last year. I'm pretty shocked by it that it's still happening, but we'll get into all of our thoughts here in a sec.
Yeah. So I guess just to couch or ground this story in context for the year, there's a Kotaku story that I'll link in the description that summarizes every video game industry layoff that has happened this year alone. That's not even counting all of the layoffs that happened last year. You know, some of the any layoff is terrible for the employees affected, but just highlighting some of the ones that crossed into the hundreds, if not thousands. Sony Interactive Entertainment last week laid off 900 people. Electronic Arts last week laid off around 670 people. Of course, several weeks ago, of course, right after we covered Xbox and we addressed it very briefly on our episode with Tom Marks, Microsoft laid off 1,900 people. So all this goes to say, this year alone, at least 8,177 people have been or will be laid off. That's again coming from a summary from Kotaku. So then with that, you know, overarching umbrella in mind, we drill into the PlayStation news from last week. This comes from Tom Warren at The Verge. Sony says it's laying off around 900 employees of its PlayStation division, a reduction of its global headcount of around 8%. Sony's layoffs will impact a variety of its PlayStation studios, including Insomniac Games, Naughty Dog, Guerrilla Games, and FireSprite. For those who might not know studios by their names, Insomniac released Spider-Man 2 last year, Naughty Dog released The Last of Us Part 2 Remastered this year, Guerrilla Games released Horizon Forbidden West not too long ago, and FireSprite released Horizon Call of the Mountain last year. Sony's layoffs are the latest in a wave that has been impacting the gaming and tech industries throughout 2024. PlayStation's chief Jim Ryan said, in response to the layoffs, "We have made the extremely hard decision to announce our plan to commence a reduction of our overall headcount globally by about 8% or about 900 people, subject to local law and consultation processes. Employees around the globe, including our studios, are impacted." Several PlayStation studios are affected, with Sony closing its London studio in the UK, which developed PlayStation VR games. In a separate note, Herman Holst, head of PlayStation Studios, confirmed US-based studios like Insomniac Games, Naughty Dog were affected alongside Guerrilla in the Netherlands. Overall, employees across the Americas, Japan, and EMEA and APAC regions will be impacted. The layoffs come just days. I think this is important context to include. The layoffs came just days after Sony missed a PS5 sales target, which led to Sony's stock plummeting by $10 billion. While the PS5 outlook wasn't what Sony was expecting, analysts also pointed toward a near-decade low games margin, suggesting that the cost of making games is eating into Sony's gaming margins. There's plenty of other context to dig into, and of course, there's also the EA news, which had a whole lot of kind of ripples following that were unexpected as well. But just starting there, Caitlin, the PlayStation 1, the PlayStation news, in some ways, you know, wasn't surprising given the trend that's happening with layoffs at the moment. But, you know, as I noted with Insomniac Games being affected and PlayStation being, you know, alongside Nintendo, just seemingly a titan of the console business and releasing games to almost undeniable critical acclaim and commercial success. Spider-Man 2 was the fourth best-selling game of last year. It's hard for it's not to be for layoffs to not be even more demoralizing when a company you see as safe and successful has layoffs like this.
Yeah. Oh man, where to begin? I guess right. Yeah, we could talk about, I mean, like, okay, when I was thinking about the layoffs in general, and there's a number of factors of like why we're seeing unprecedented amount of layoffs that have to do with just the pandemic boom and companies having a lot of money, and maybe that led to like poor decision making, poor budgetary reasons. But like you said, like Spider-Man being one of the most successful games of last year, like it's crazy to think that even a company like that would be befallen to layoffs. But I can't remember who did it, but there was, I guess I'll talk about, like, there was hacked documents that revealed that Spider-Man 2 cost $300 million, and this, like, when I was thinking of reasons why, like, number one is how much money games cost to make right now, because games are just like larger, like takes more time to make. The pandemic caused like games were much longer. Everyone had to adjust to work from home. That's not to say that that means going back to an office is going to make that easier. That is not what I'm saying. But there was a lot of changes that happened, and Sony is not immune, or Insomniac is not immune to this. So even though Spider-Man 2 costs three times the original game, it wasn't three times longer. It wasn't three times like the size. It's just the costs are almost unsustainable. It costs so much money to make video games. And I think that with these companies getting so much money during the pandemic, because we saw like there's a huge boom, more people had more time to play games, we're buying consoles, we're buying individual games, like these companies could spend this money and maybe weren't so focused on like how to cut costs in ways that were not just by like firing employees. And instead we're just like, you have to pay your employees. You have to make this game, get it out, and then like adjust. And I don't entirely think that is smart planning, but I think that's what has just happened. And now that like the game is out, the company is now looking at like, okay, how much is it going to cost for them to make their next game? How much money do they have on hand? Like they have to make changes. And unfortunately that is being like employees are eating that. And I don't think that's like fair to them in any way. I think a lot of this comes to like very poor leadership and financial like budgeting and like poor investment decisions. But yeah, $300 million for Spider-Man 2 when Spider-Man 1 was $100 million. Like that is a huge difference. And I think like if we're looking forward to looking ahead at like what does this mean for Insomniac or like all these like major studios, I think they need to start working smarter. I think we need to like be using tools, and maybe that means AI, but like when I say I mean like generative AI, something that's going to like actually like help developers make games quicker. I don't know. I think a lot needs to happen. I think they need to be smarter. I think a lot of leadership needs to reevaluate budgeting and where they're putting their money and maybe how much they're paying themselves and some of the top leadership. And like, what do your bonuses look like for top execs when like you should not be taking hundreds of millions of dollars home if you're having to cut hundreds of employees in the same year?
Yeah, there was, like you said, what's so hard about now finally doing largely a whole episode on this is like where to begin, where to pull apart. Like you mentioned so many things that are worth diving into, whether it's just, you know, wheeling back the multiple trends and industry factors that led to this moment, whether, you know, like you said, the pandemic boom and overhiring that happened in 2020 and 2021 that are largely cited by many companies, you know, starting last year into this year of laying off mass numbers of employees. That is one thing, sure. But again, that also goes back to, like you said, that management should be held accountable or needs to take accountability for the layoffs that happened as part of that, because that is a miscalculation in how these businesses are built and accounting for what their growth trend is. But then, like you said, yeah, the cost of games rising is putting a lot of hot water under these big companies, especially something like PlayStation, whose consoles are sold on the backs, and that might be a little dramatic, but you know, the PlayStation brand is made up by games like Spider-Man 2, The Last of Us Remastered, Last of Us Part 2. But those games, like you said, in just, when was Spider-Man 2 released? I want to say that was 2018. Just 5 years later, we're looking at a game that's three times as expensive. You know, we talked about, when we talked about the Xbox news a couple weeks ago, that hardware, the margin is slim. You know, these PlayStation, Nintendo, Microsoft aren't making a whole lot of money on those games themselves. They're making money on, you know, the revenue share that they get from software being sold on their stores by other publishers. But of course, for a long time, PlayStation also could make money off of the juggernaut blockbuster success of games that I just named. But if those games are becoming more and more expensive, and those are also becoming loss leaders for the company as well, that leads to a breaking point. And like, this is the worst kind of breaking point. Again, 900 people affected by this, but I do think it signals that some sort of change, as you indicated, has to happen from the way these massive AAA games are made, or else, you know, push comes to shove in some way, and we're seeing the break now.
Yeah, I think like part of it's almost they're just getting stuck in like this cycle of like layoffs that's going to continue to happen. I know like during the pandemic, while with like all this massive hiring, and just like recently, a lot of companies were struggling to hire like the top talent, like leads, like lead game designers. And they were just like, there's a lot of hiring of entry level positions, or maybe just like anything lower than like the top positions. And like those people, you have to give them time to learn and grow, and like you have to teach them. And having someone who's like at a company for a year or for like one game and then firing them, and then they have got to go somewhere else, like you're losing a lot of like learned and just a lot of learned knowledge about how a company operates. And you're just, I think in the long run, you're just spending more money because you have to keep retraining people and then firing them and then like rehiring. And that is just like, I don't understand how that's sustainable for any company. And especially for the longevity of a company. I know like we may have mentioned this on the podcast before, but I always look at like Iwata and like Nintendo's hiring practices, and they like basically the people who work on their games have been working there for decades. Like they don't fire people, and I don't know the statistics, but I imagine they're probably pretty efficient when it comes to making games at Nintendo because of this, because they've been there like their entire careers. They're not worried, or they're not as worried as anybody else working in the industry of like losing their jobs, because Nintendo has this like strict hiring standard that they've set for themselves. I don't know. It's just,
go ahead. Nintendo's Sam. A really interesting point. I talked about this on, I post a podcast with my brother, and he highlighted how we don't see a whole lot of, I mean, the labor laws are so wildly different. I mean, just country by country, the PlayStation 1 really shined a light on that, in the way that, you know, basically anybody working in North America was found out and they were laid off near effective immediately, whereas it's going to need to go through negotiation and maybe even potentially litigation in the EU. And even in Japan, it's even much harder to lay off people. So that's its own thing. But like you said, yeah, there's not just that about the Japanese companies being much less likely to lay off staff at all, but they retain them and they keep them for decades. And it leads to really interesting things, like, you know, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is the talk of gaming releases right now. And one of the things I've found so endearing and really inspiring about that game is the number of people that have been at Square Enix since 97 and have stuck around and found themselves in such drastically different roles and much, you know, to some degree, more prominent roles on the remake trilogy than they were on the original game. There were people credited as events planners on the original 7. Now, maybe events planning is a job title that means something different in game dev that I'm not aware of, or maybe they were people planning launch parties for Final Fantasy VII in the 90s, but now they're working in the design of Rebirth now. And if we're not keeping around junior employees and bringing them up through the ranks and, you know, letting that creative vision create the new swath of ideas, that's how we got something like Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, is fusing the old school Zelda design with new school ideas. It's discouraging. And that's what's worrying about these layoffs, is if young people can't build a career in this space, or they're discouraged to, you know, it just leads to massive burnout, and it's not healthy for anybody in the long term or the short term.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a certain level of turnover that is healthy for a company, because it leads to like increased diversity and growth. But a high percentage of turnover is not a good thing. I mean, like, if you have employees that are not satisfied or they're not like engaged and loyal, and I know that that's usually for like people leaving, but if you're firing a lot of people and everybody else that company is does not trust their leadership or doesn't trust, they don't have job security, like that is such an added stress to a person's life that you can't just leave at the door when you get to a job. Like that, it's going to affect your entire life. It's going to affect your sleep and your work habits and how much effort you're putting into things. Cause you're like, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if you are making a game that is in the top 10 best-selling games of the year, there's still a chance that you're going to get let go regardless. And it has nothing to do with your job performance and 100% to do with like everything else and leadership and like how they've been planning. So like at the end of the day, why would you want that? It's you're ending up with like less quality work and employees that are unhappy. And I would think that anybody who's human would not want that. And I don't know, it's just always baffling to me how some people like manage companies. And I don't know, I'm not a CEO of a company, so can't say I have any experience there. But at the end of the day, like I am a manager and I do under like I want the people that I'm working with and the people that I'm managing to be happy, because I know that when I'm happy, I'm producing better quality work because I have higher energy. I'm less stressed. I'm not worried every time I go to sleep. Like, am I going to wake up to a you're fired? Like, especially coming from someone who has been let go in the past, like that trauma sticks with you and it's not great and it affects every aspect of your life and your work. Anyways, I'm going on a tangent about all this, but like, I know that's what we're here to talk about.
That's appropriate. Yeah. Very appropriate for this conversation. Also, you know, talking about management and how people are affected by this, you look again to, you know, just comparing territory by territory and how people deal with these situations. When Nintendo was down in the early 2010s or mid 2010s during the Wii U era, their executive suite took pay cuts. You know, Satoru Iwata and Miyamoto took pay cuts to weather the storm through a really down period for that company rather than lay off a bunch of staff. And again, by doing that, they retained a bunch of people who helped, you know, stick around and make the switch, you know, through software, such a up, you know, moment for that company. And sure, when it comes to cost cutting, layoffs are the easiest thing to go to, because people are the most expensive thing on the bottom line, but people are also the things that give company its, you know, or creatives their lifeblood and make the games that we love in the first place. So yeah. it's like it, demoralized laugh is what that was. Anything you want to jump to from here, or should I introduce like the EA
I was thinking like, yeah, go ahead and like jump to EA, because I think that's a little bit of a different beast in itself.
It is. Yeah. Speaking of ways to cost cut, I think there is a bit of reading between the lines we can do here. Rebecca Valentine at IGN writes that Electronic Arts has announced that it too is undergoing mass layoffs with plans to let go 5% of its total global staff, or roughly 670 individuals. In a note sent to staff, CEO Andrew Wilson said that EA is reacting to, quote, accelerating industry transformation where player needs and motivations have changed significantly. Crucially, EA also said that it is moving away from the development of future licensed IP. EA currently has several confirmed Star Wars and Marvel games in development, including a third Jedi game, Black Panther, and Iron Man. We've since learned that EA is canceling Respawn's Star Wars first-person shooter, which was announced last year but had not been fully revealed. According to Wilson, EA will double down on owned IP, sports, and massive online communities. While Wilson did not provide details on which games would be sunset, EA already announced it would be shuttering two mobile games, F1 Mobile Racing and MLB Tap Sports. IGN understands that these layoffs will impact a number of teams across EA, largely affecting support teams. While some developers will also be impacted, EA largely hopes to move them off of canceled projects and onto other teams. Per Wilson, these changes are already being communicated and will largely be completed by early next quarter. You know, some context, and I'm going to do some quick searching to just get exact information here, but some follow-ups we've learned since then that the Star Wars strategy game being overseen by Respawn is safe. That has not been canceled. Iron Man, Black Panther, and the third Star Wars Jedi game are, according to all of our understanding, still in development. Whereas, again, this Star Wars first-person shooter game is canceled. There was a studio opened, and I'm going to search around for the exact name of it, founded by the co-creator of Halo that was started to work on narrative Battlefield titles. That studio is being shut down and the staff are being reorganized onto other studios already working on Battlefield content. So that's all of the EA news at the offset. I mean, just jumping right into what I hinted at earlier, another way to cut costs and you know, tighten the bottom line in a year where interest rates are really high and returns are looking lower than past years is licensing. You know, not just layoffs, but during the Insomniac leak last year, it came out that, you know, it costs a considerable amount of money to like, I believe the number thrown around was like upwards of like close to $100 million for the Spider-Man license. And that is huge. And even if there aren't licensing fees on the offset, you do share then some of the revenue with the rights holders, whether it's Disney or whoever else you're working with from a licensing standpoint. And I can see if you're looking to make the most of your bottom dollar on your game sales, one way to do that is make games where you don't have to share any of your revenue with somebody else. So I, you know, given all the talk we do about licensing in games, whether that's in games themselves or to movies and TV, I was surprised to see this way change from EA as part of their layoffs announcements. But it did, I think, at least shed light on a bit more strategy on where EA is heading as a company, whereas other layoff announcements often are kind of just couched in the past of being like, we made decisions strategically and hiring wise on the growth of the company that weren't right. You know, here we're getting an additional reason that EA is moving away from a lot of their license development. What was your reaction to all of this?
Oh, I agree with everything that you just said. And I think another part of this that I was thinking about, like, just has to do with franchises and IPs in general and how, like, I think at the end of the day, like, even if EA was changing their strategy, they also have to, like, they have contracts with Disney, so like Lucasfilm's games and Marvel and everything that they were working on, and they can't just, I don't think they could just like go out and cancel those games. So part of me kind of wondered if a lot of this came down from like Lucasfilm's changing their strategy on like the Star Wars games in general, and if EA was like, okay, like if they're maybe putting a pause on releasing those games, like then EA also has to change their strategy. And like EA has already sort of been like focusing on their own IPs as of late. I think there was something about like the FIFA titles being moved to like, they've been branding it more of like EA Sports versus like
EA Sports
FIFA
FC.
Or FC. Yep. So like, I kind of wonder if this is like a couple things are happening where it's like EA's already been moving away from IP. Perhaps Lucasfilms, or just, I'll just say Disney in general, is changing how they're approaching franchises and IPs. I wouldn't be surprised. I think like we've seen, I think Disney has learned from the Disney Plus model of that more does not equal better with the number of like Disney shows and Star Wars shows and movies, and like sometimes oversaturation is not a good thing, and that doesn't always mean that like franchises and IPs are going to sell. It's not going to sell tickets, it's not going to sell games. So instead of like relying on that, maybe they're shifting to like, okay, little bit more moderation, focusing more on like what they think is going to be an actual good game versus like an okay game that has an IP slapped to it. I will say I am mourning the loss of the Mandalorian game, the Bounty Hunter.
Oh my gosh.
That just sounded awesome, but who knows? I don't know. Maybe it just like wasn't shaping up and EA and Lucasfilms or Lucas Games were just like, you know what? Let's not waste any more money on this. And I know EA mentioned like they're trying to put as much people on other projects as they can. So to me, I sort of feel like this wasn't completely on EA because I don't think they could have canceled all of these games without that coming down from their partner.
Yeah, there's something interesting with the Mandalorian of it all. Is like the canceled Mandalorian game, which I too would have loved. That really excited me because it reminded me of the long ago days of licensed games where there were several in every franchise release all the time. I'm thinking specifically like the PS2 era with Bounty Hunter and the Clone Wars and Battlefront and all these different explorations of Star Wars canon, and many of which did not feature Jedi. And I think, again, returning to the cost of games nowadays, that the size of games have become too big to accommodate weirder experiments in licensing that, you know, could have been done when games were cheaper to make and took much less time. You know, most likely this Mandalorian first person shooter game was probably going to take 3-4 plus years from Respawn and likely whether it, you know, was a joint Lucasfilm, Disney or EA decision or some mix of those, probably just made the most sense for EA to put those resources toward Apex Legends or some other first-person project that I'm interested to see. Speaking of first-person projects, again, returning to the theme of EA trying to find homes for as many employees as possible, given studios affected. What I was hinting at earlier or alluding to was that EA is shuttering Ridgeline Games. This comes from Kat Bailey at IGN. Ridgeline Games is the studio co-founded by former Halo developer Marcus Lehto that was tasked with developing the narrative campaign in the next Battlefield. The closure follows word of Lehto's departure earlier this week and coincides with a broader restructuring announced that we just talked about, 670 employees affected. The work that the studio was doing on the Battlefield single-player campaign will continue. In an internal note, EA Entertainment president Laurie Meal said that Criterion producer Danny Isaac and studio head of creative Darren White will replace Lehto to continue work on the planned narrative campaign, with some members of Ridgeline Games joining Ripple Effect, which was another studio DICE LA was renamed to Ripple Effect in 2021. So Ridgeline is joining that team to continue work on Battlefield. So, you know, it seems to be me that we're entering a new era of EA that is, you know, because, you know, they had a 10-year deal with Star Wars and that defined a lot of their releases for a while with Battlefront and the Jedi games. And, so here we are, and it looks like they're doubling down again on sports and their owned racing titles, and maybe the Titanfall brand will see a bit of a revival since Apex is as popular as it is. I'm curious to see.
Me too. And yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it all means, to be frank, but we'll see. I also kind of wonder if, like, I know this is, they're not working, these weren't Warner Bros. Brothers titles, but I also kind of wonder if, like, the reception to Suicide Squad, the Justice League, also had something to do with this, that IP does not equal guarantee profits. I know Warner Brothers is, like, they're going to be focusing on free-to-play live service games, in, I think, despite of Kill the Justice League. I'm not sure if that's 100% the right way to go about it either, if that's the right takeaway. But again, like we've talked about, I'm not entirely sure a lot of these decisions are, I don't know if they're just super reactionary and not looking as big picture, but who knows? They probably know more information than we do at the moment because they have all the inside juice.
Yeah, I mean, specifically looking at EA, I think Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League is a totally good shout. And the other thing is just, you mentioned Disney Plus. Disney and Star Wars and Marvel are not at their hottest point right now. The general consumer excitement for those brands are down. It's been a long time since a Marvel movie has grossed $1 billion at the box office, which was for a long time an almost expected milestone for those movies to cross. And Star Wars isn't even a movie franchise at the moment. So EA getting out of that business, that also might be another factor at play there.
Yeah, definitely think so. I think when those franchises are at their peak, yeah, it probably makes a little bit more sense to spend more money and put out games because there's a lot of excitement and interest around those projects. When those franchises are looking a little down and interest is dwindling, yeah, I think it's time to go back to the drawing board and, I don't know, just make a game that's exciting. Like, make a game that makes sense for the IP as well. I'm looking at Kill the Justice League, where it's like, I think for that kind of game, it just didn't make sense for those characters. It's just like, the dots weren't connected in the way that like they could have been. And maybe that was the case with the Mandalorian game and like a lot of other things where things just weren't making sense, and they realized that it's not going to justify the dollar amount.
Yeah, you mentioned I hate to keep like dogpiling on Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League, but it is indicative of a lot of trends that I think have led to this moment that we're in now. And that game also just took a exorbitantly long time to make. But
yeah,
games are, as we talked earlier about, like, you know, Spider-Man 2 and other things, like games are just getting not just more expensive to make, but taking longer to make. And that's a tough factor. Like, it's a square peg round hole thing where it doesn't exactly fit with licensed games, because if you're starting a Marvel Star Wars thing, who knows what the state of that thing is in 5 years, when most likely, or 4 years, when that game finally is ready to hit the market. Like, that's really risky. And so if, like you said at the very top of this conversation, if the solution isn't, which personally I was very much like to see it be, games taking, you know, less expensive games taking less time to make, even if that means they're not as big, as ambitious as you know, everything we're getting right now, and maybe that's so that there can be one really big one that a publisher is making for several years. In the meantime, they can release smaller things. But if that's not the solution, then it definitely can't be trying to like chase a trend that might not be around in 5 years.
That's a very good point. And yeah, I didn't mean that as like dogpiling on Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
I will say, like, from what I saw and heard, a lot of it is like quite enjoyable. I think there's just more criticism placed on it, or critique, because it's based off of already established characters. And with that, you get people who love those characters have this, there's more like, I don't even want to say entitlement, because that's not entirely the right word, but there's just, they're expecting a level of quality, and I think like they want it to make sense for those characters in that world. And if it doesn't exactly like match up, they're going to be a little bit more loud and angry and upset, versus like if this game was original characters and like that confusing everything now. But if it had been its own thing, the reception might have been more positive, because it wasn't already tied to something that people already love and have a lot of opinions on and are looking for something very specific and true to those characters. It just adds more risk, which is what you were talking about with like, there's also risk in it. Who knows what public reception to those IPs and franchises are going to be in 5 years. There's also more risk in the reception with the fan bases. And if you don't, if you don't get that perfect, like, you're dead in the water, to be dramatic.
Yeah. It's a tough business, like, clearly, in making AAA games these days. And part of what we're, you know, you look at Jason Schreier's Blood, Sweat, and Pixels, which is a book I would recommend, highly recommend. And, you know, one of the themes of that, or Press Reset, which I guess is more digging into what I'm about to talk about, which is the cycle of layoffs. And I don't want to reduce what we're talking about here to just a part of a cycle, because this is so much bigger than what we're used to in the past. But I think part of why this is so disastrous is, for a long time, as Jason describes in this book, a lot of what happened in game dev was studios would release a title and then they would lay off sometimes hundreds of people because they would go back into pre-pro and they wouldn't have a job or responsibilities for these, you know, more late stage dev talent until another year or two when the game is ready to enter into full production. And savvily, and as they should, companies, especially in the age of live service games, have done a better job of swapping and implementing people and plugging them in after one project wraps into another thing. Insomniac even does that with, between Miles Morales into Ratchet and Clank Rift Apart into Spider-Man 2. Respawn, looking at EA, can do the same thing with Apex and Star Wars Jedi and other things they're working on. But part of me, and this is such a like a dark way to look at it, but part of me wonders if, like, with that reshuffling and the way these staffs have built up, that those layoffs that used to happen after every game launched, which was terrible in the first place, all had like built up to this moment. And again, that's an issue of management, but I think that's somewhat like also fueling this terrible fire that we're talking about this week. I don't even know if that makes sense. I was just trying to like break down, like, no, I feel like it's been such a long time since a cycle like this has happened, and why is that?
Yeah, there are just so many reasons, and I don't know if there was a way to, I'm sure there were ways to, I don't even like lessen the number of layoffs, but I think the recent years, there's just the industry, the games industry is going through a change, and we're going to see that change continue to happen. I think we're just in that period right now of trying to figure out what works and what doesn't with the new way of like making video games and working from home. And again, I do not think the answer is to go back into an office. I think we've touched on that on this podcast, because there's been some return to office things happening of late, or I've just talked about this in general with colleagues, but I think that is the wrong approach. And like, just because something worked pre-pandemic doesn't mean that's going to work today, or it means like we should go back to the way things work. I think we need to find new ways of working together and new ways of like making video games, finding new tools, using generative AI to help your developers, not replace jobs. I need to be very clear so that nobody comes for me. But I think there are like, and lots of developers have talked about that, like generative AI and many other tools would like be great so that they can focus on other things and they don't have to write 1,000 lines of like NPC dialogue. They could take the time to review it and then make changes and like focus on creating exciting plot lines or whatever else they're doing. Developers do a lot. I think that, but
yeah, AI can most certainly
be easier.
Yeah, it can most certainly be a creative enhancement, not a creative replacement. And I think, yeah, again, returning to what knobs and pulleys have to like be changed in order for this, for us to go from here and find improvement, not just to find ourselves in another layoff cycle in a couple of years from now. And if the solution isn't games getting less expensive or games taking less long to develop or games with staff sizes that they are being what they are, maybe it is the way we find them coming out sooner and thus like shrinking the budgets on something like a Spider-Man 2 is using these tools to help speed up certain processes that like slow the pipeline of asset generation and just the scale of making AAA games of what they've become today. I think that's a totally good good observation.
Yeah, because I think I may have mentioned it where like, or I had this in my notes where like, yeah, a lot of AAA games are really massive and this has been a trend to like make them bigger than ever. And I think there's, I don't think the answer is to stop making big games. I think that could be part of it, is that not every game needs to be a massive game. Some can be, if it makes sense. But where was I going with this? Like, so, like they also don't need to be massive games. And so, yeah, anyways, to like help with them, asset creation with the massive games, like absolutely, but also take a look at what game you're making, and if it doesn't make sense to be a massive AAA game, don't be a massive AAA game.
Yeah. Another one last like reading between the lines I wanted to do with the news from last week, which is like the state of specifically PlayStation VR 2 with you know, when the Insomniac leak happened in December, there were emails going around that there were potentially going to be layoffs that happened at Insomniac, and unfortunately now we know they did, but that PlayStation was also considering closing one of their studios, and we now know that the studio was closed. This is London Studio, which for a long time in its history had made many of the best games on PSVR 1, Blood and Truth, which was a really cool kind of Guy Ritchie style heist game on that platform, was made by them. And you know, it's funny because VR I think is an exciting spot as it's ever been this year, between all of the cool stuff that Meta is making. Caveat, they are one of our clients, but of course Apple Vision Pro is also coming out of one of the biggest tech companies in the world right now. And it is just like, from the PlayStation fan and just general observational viewpoint, disappointing that they didn't go harder on PSVR 2. I think if anything coming from this is like, I'm curious if there's going to be any messaging or reassurances that Sony, that PlayStation themselves are going to continue supporting it, because there will be devs continue to releasing ports on it because people own that that hardware. But I think there's still, you know, going to be exciting stuff on Meta and Apple and other products. But like, I think Sony, in order to make a case for buying a $500 PS5 and then another, oh gosh, it's been so long since I've looked at that price point. I want to say it might be another, at least, yeah, to get a VR2 headset. That is a case when I think exclusives really do matter. And if you're actively, is it 400?
It's $550. Me thinking $300 was way too much.
Yeah. I don't know. This all goes, like, reading that from the headlines like last week did not make me any more confident in the future of PSVR 2 as we see it right now. So I'm curious if there is like a PlayStation showcase in the summer or the fall, if they have some ace up their sleeve in terms of, you know, killer app for that platform that we might not be underestimating, because right now they're not instilling a whole lot of confidence as me and someone who liked my PSVR 1 and want a reason to buy the second unit.
Yeah, I don't entirely know where their market is. Oh, you mentioned it, like it really should be exclusives. That's I think the only logical path for the PSVR 2 to be successful, because Meta's got, they have that, the general consumer, they've got like the price options, Apple Vision Pro, yes, Apple Vision Pro, I don't know why I know this. Like, their audience is a little bit different. Their audience is like people who are already bought into an Apple ecosystem and have never probably owned a VR headset. Or someone like me, like I own the Quest 2 and I enjoy it. I actually will probably get a Quest 3 at some point in the future, because I generally really like Meta's headsets and the games that are on there. But like, I also really want to try the Apple Vision Pro. And if it wasn't $3,500 starting, which like that's the, there's a more expensive option for more storage. And if you're like me and you're going to be using it to watch movies, I probably would need that. I'm looking at $4,000 at least. Like, that's unrealistic. I can't do that. So hopefully down the line, Apple will release a little bit of a cheaper option. But their audience is like people who want to like continue using the ecosystem and use it with their other products. For people like me who are just going to use it for other entertainment purposes when it comes to television and movies. And I really think they have an opportunity to like target the sports, like live sports and filming that and like watching a Lakers game courtside. But yeah, so like they have their own niche market. Meta's got a handle on like a general wide super. There's a bunch of other headsets too that have that are in the market, and then PSVR 2 is just there, and you're asking people $500 to spend $550 on top of what is the PS5 also $500?
Yeah, if you're buying the disc version.
Yes, which is that's the one I have. So that's over $1,000 for a VR headset that's got like a fraction of the games that Meta has at the moment.
Yeah.
Though, thank you to our producer just sent us a message. Apparently PSVR 2 is looking, it's like they're looking for PC support as well.
Yes, which that was a, like, vastly expand the hardware and or the software lineup. And that then makes a case for, I've not gone hands-on with the PSVR 2 myself, but if it is comfortable and people just like the controller and in new controllers, that maybe there is a small demographic of people that are interested in just like buying that standalone and using Steam VR with it. But
right. But why would you?
I don't think that's the, like, exactly. I don't think that's the solution.
If you could buy a Quest, yeah, for like $300 or $350, like something the fraction of the price. And you're just, you still get Steam VR and you get the Meta games that are on Meta, that, you know, pretty much every VR game that comes out is on the Meta store, unless it's a PSVR 2 exclusive. And at this point, there's just not enough to justify purchasing. Unless you're like the world's biggest Horizon fan and you're like, I need to play this game more than anything else. But that's, can't imagine that's a lot of people. That was not shade at Horizon. I know it came out that way, and I am not the Horizon's biggest fan, but I did not mean that as shade to Horizon.
No, it's fair. Like, it's got to be more than just Horizon Call of the Mountain and Resident Evil 4 VR, which are all very cool. Because they're exclusives, I've not played them myself, but to my understanding, and by that I mean Resident Evil 4 Remake VR. The VR version of the original Resident Evil 4 is very fun, but you can't play that on Quest. So it's got to be more than just that.
Yeah.
Well, to close this episode on a lighter note, one place I would like to go to in VR is Arrakis, because the talk of the movie town transitioning into real time strategy, of course, is the first big blockbuster of 2024. What was once going to be one of the big blockbusters of 2023 before it was delayed by the strikes, that is, of course, Dune Part 2. You know, don't just take it from me. Take it from the box office results. It opened to 81.5 million. Do you like my just, movie guy voice?
Yeah, not me just Googling Dune 2 box office numbers so that I could do that. Sorry. Anyways, continue your movie voice.
Shania Russell at Entertainment Weekly writes that movie theaters have found the blockbuster of the year. It's Dune Part 2. It opened to 81.5 million domestically and 178.5 million worldwide.
It's actually, as of 22 minutes ago, it is over 200 million.
Oh, let's go. Dune Hive Rise Up Part 3. Let's have it. For the sake of this show, for if we want to even talk about the movie itself, I wanted to talk about it on the show because there is a Dune survival MMO called Dune Awakening. It's coming from Funcom, and I remember seeing this at a Summer Game Fest, or it was some kind of showcase within the last year or two, and I remember it looking cool. It was an atmospheric CGI trailer, and it kind of fallen off my radar, but Funcom very savvily scheduled what they called the Dune Awakening Direct on Monday, coming right off of Dune Hive hype everybody's seen it in theaters, you know, again, not just to commercial success, but critical success. It's the only thing I see on Twitter. And boom, you now have your first actual look at gameplay for this thing running in Unreal Engine 5. So there's also, you know, were you blown away by the visuals of the movie? Well, take a look at the visuals of this game too. It is, you know, not up to par. I was impressed by the timing of this, because again, we're long past the days of movie tie-in games, but if you can at the very least have some sort of beat around the release of your related property, it's a great way to get more eyes on it, especially when I don't pay attention to a whole lot of survival MMOs anyway. So this was a great way to remind me that, oh, this property and world I really care about has a game that looks cool, and now I kind of want to check it out.
Yeah, I think the timing of this was perfect. I saw that they had flown out some press for a hands-off preview ahead of the embargo lift, which was today. And a lot of the previews that I've seen were like really pretty positive. I think, like you said, it was the Dune Direct. So part of the what they released today was the, I don't know, it was like a 1:30 or 2-minute trailer. And then was it 30 minutes? They had like a deep dive with some of the game developers to really talk about the game more in depth for really like the gaming audience. I think dropping both on the same day is a great way to target both the people who saw the movie and were like, oh, I am totally into Arrakis and Dune and want to know more. And I've probably gone and bought the books, and I actually hope this comes out. I would love to see the increased percentage of book sales for the Dune series after this past weekend. And for like those people who may be interested in a game, to like go watch that trailer. And then for those of us who work in the industry or like love video games and are maybe a bit more skeptical about movie tie-in games, I think the Direct really answered a lot of questions people would have on, like, I guess just instilling confidence in the people who made it. And I haven't watched the full Direct. I've just read some articles and watched the initial trailer. I do plan on watching the more in-depth video. Just have not had time. Like we said, GDC's coming up. It's been busy, but
I'm
looking forward to it. Also, I apologize. Point. My camera was out of focus, so I'm going to try and fix that.
You make a good point, though, that it isn't just the timing of it that's savvy. It's the messaging of it, not just the trailer, which, again, I highlighted the Unreal Engine 5, and that kind of runs through what is now public understanding of what the Dune franchise can be, and that it is technology pushing whatever medium it's coming out in. But also that part of this Direct was, how are we adapting the world? Because that has been so much a part of the messaging of Denis interviews and talking about making part one and part two. So to then carry that on to the game itself, about being, how are we taking elements from the games and now the movies and bringing that into something that feels loyal to both swaths of fans, whether you've never touched Frank Herbert's book or you've just seen the movies. So that I thought was a fun little tie-in and an excuse to talk about Dune this week, which I am still thinking about, even though I saw an early screening of it like a week and a half ago. Caitlin, I assume I don't think I've seen a review from you on Letterboxd. Have you seen it yet?
I have not. I've been bad. I don't know. Just, I need to get to it. I will. I'm excited to be proven wrong for my Dune 1 review. Or actually, I don't know about proven wrong. I think I said in my Dune 1 review that I was questionable, iffy after the first movie, but I theorized that Denis would probably knock it out of the park with the second one, and it would probably be a fantastic space opera and on par with many other giants in the industry when it comes to sci-fi. So I'm looking forward to it. I just would not call myself the number one Dune fan after part one. But I am open to that changing. Also, I have never seen a man more bald in my life than Austin Butler. And we're watching the trailers like playing right now on the screen, and it actually instills a fear in me that I didn't know existed, but it's there.
I was reading a featurette about its making, and his bald cap apparently went all the way down, or not bald cap, but the bald makeup went all the way down past his eyebrows. So he didn't have to shave anything, but it took 3 hours to get him balded up for that movie.
He looked like he bathed in Nair for like 3 years. Shout out to millennial girls who grew up in middle school had to use Nair. Also, I don't think my camera is going to focus for the rest of this podcast. I'm slightly out of focus, and I apologize.
It's okay. We're wrapping up. My quick thoughts on Dune Part 2. Really, I mean, I love the book. Loved Part 2. It has its shortcomings, but I think, Caitlin, at the very least, from a spectacle and filmmaking point of view, it's mm-hmm. kind of undeniable. Denis bringing all of his learnings from making Arrival and Blade Runner 2049 and just making some of the most awe-inspiring action set pieces and visuals that I've seen in a really long time, whether it is the Arrakis set aerial fights or the Colosseum Austin Butler scene that's shown in the trailer there. It's also just a fun watching a movie star movie with the top 12 build people, kind of the same phenomenon as like Barbie or Oppenheimer last year, of just being like, oh, like,
yeah,
I recognize the top 20 build people here. Go on.
No, it's totally fine. I was just going to say, I am also looking forward to being proven wrong about my Timothée Chalamet thoughts.
So.
Or not.
I don't think he's bad. Wonka has kind of made me wonder if like little sly goofball Timmy is the best use of him. Because he comes from a cheesy theater kid background.
Wait, as in like you're pro cheesy goofball or anti-cheesy goofball?
I think I'm pro cheesy goofball.
Okay, that's where I'm landing. That's how I felt after Wonka. I was like, I think I really like him in the comedic roles more than dramatic lead roles.
Yeah,
that's just from what I've seen so far. Again, I need to see Dune Part 2. I thought about trying to squeeze it in, but I am having car problems and I just didn't feel like risking driving right now. So we'll get to it soon.
Yes, we will get to it soon. And we'll get to next week's episode exactly on Wednesday when you can expect it. This has been Real Time Strategy. You can find us everywhere at Real Time Strats. Email us questions at podcasts@triplepointpr.com. Caitlin, where can the people find you?
They can find me at Caitlin Redwing everywhere. Letterboxd, Twitter, Instagram.
Love it. You can find me everywhere at Sam Scott Mosier. We'll be back next week with another episode of Real Time Strategy. But until then, thank you all so much for listening.
Thanks. Bye.